This Biz News briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees. Well, it's Monday, the 27th of January. I'm back from the Alpine visit of the last week. Hopefully, a little more wiser than when I departed there. We're going to be talking a bit about the World Economic Forum in Davos in a moment with David Ansara. That's our top story for today. But coming back home, you can hear that there's really one big issue at the moment. In fact, as we speak, the Democratic Alliance's federal executive are meeting to decide what to do after being shunned again by the African National Congress. Is this a ANC perpetuation of its rule or a real government of national unity? Well, there's quite a lot of debate on that subject that we're going to be talking about today. Also bringing you up to date with the markets, where the introduction of China's DeepSeek has sent shockwaves through the international appreciation for artificial intelligence, hammering back the shares of many of the highest flyers on the stock markets around the world. We'll have more on that for you later as well. But let's kick off now with the top story today, and I have pulled out a little clip of the conversation with David Ansara. He's the chief executive of the Free Market Foundation. The full interview can be accessed on BizNews TV, but let's listen in.
The president himself put pen to paper on the Expropriation Act. He clearly doesn't care about achieving sufficient consensus within the GNU. Obviously, you only leave the GNU once, unless some other formation is formed. But I think the bargaining position has been weakened by the rhetoric that built up to the GNU, and also during the GNU, where the DA has said, well, we had no choice. We had to act in service of the national interest to save the country from a potential MK or EFF coalition with the ANC. And so that may or may not be a valid argument, but now it's very difficult for that same DA to then say, well, now we're fed up and we're leaving the GNU, because the ANC itself and the broader public can say, well, what about this so-called doomsday coalition that you warned us against? So the DA is in a very awkward position now. And unfortunately, I think it is largely of its own making. And I think what it should have been doing is being much more aggressive. We should be hearing from the various ministers, and Minister McPherson in particular, to say, under no circumstances will I implement expropriation without compensation under my watch. My duty is towards the constitution that I swore an oath to, rather than trying to maintain some kind of civility with the ANC. He should be bringing that conflict to a head. So I'll be curious to see how this Section 19 process goes and the ways in which that conflict is dealt with within the GNU. But ultimately, you have to have bargaining power. You have to be able to follow through on threats of dissolving the government. And part of it is about shaming the ANC as well, to say, you know, it is unconscionable that you would even contemplate going into a coalition with the EFF and MK. That will help to soften the ground in terms of motivating for potentially leaving the GNU, which I think they should.
I'm reminded here of what Franz Grenier has been saying and said at one of the BizNews conferences, I think the one in London earlier, ahead of the election. He said that the whole strategy of the ANC, inherited from its socialist forebears, is that you push the bayonet in until you hit steel. Until you hit steel, you just keep pushing. And it does appear to be very much that kind of strategy at the moment. But I'm going to take you back to the whole story of the expropriation without compensation, which really ruffled a lot of feathers in Davos, not least because the way that the world appears to be moving is in a very different direction. Let's have a watch of a very short section of President Milei's speech, for which he was warmly applauded. And as mentioned earlier, well, all the reports that came out of Davos, he really was elevated in his way of thinking. But let's just listen very closely. I would like to, in particular, get your thoughts on what he says about private property.
That Argentina had been infected with socialism for far too long, and that with us it would once again embrace the ideas of freedom, a model that we summarize as the defense of life, liberty, and private property. And I also told you that, in a way, Argentina was the ghost of Western Christmases yet to come, because we had already experienced everything you were going through, and we already knew how it would end.
You can hear in the background the original, David, of in Spanish that he was saying, and of course then the important part for the context of this conversation is he says, we go for freedom. We are re-implementing freedom in Argentina, which means the promotion of life, liberty, and private property. Private property, which is exactly the opposite to what Cyril Ramaphosa signed into law last week.
Yeah, and private property rights are the building blocks of a free society and a prosperous economy. You really cannot have one without the other. So, and I often say that you either have private property rights or you don't. It's a binary situation. It's like being pregnant. You can't be half pregnant. You either are or you aren't. And I, you know, we at the Free Market Foundation have been campaigning for many, many years, pushing back against EWC, defending private property rights, but also advancing it through initiatives like the Kaya Lum Project, which is a title deed transfer project where, to date, since 2010, we've transferred over 18,000 title deeds, working with conveyancers, donors, and also municipalities to get title deeds into the hands of low-income homeowners who were once tenants of the state under apartheid. So we don't just believe in pushing back against threats to private property rights. We also want to extend private property rights to all.
Really good stuff there by David Ansara, and I strongly recommend that you go and pick that up on BizNews TV. Well, conversation with David, because of the context and because of the subject, is not really anything but very serious. Neil DeBeer, on the other hand, somehow manages to inject humor into everything that he talks about, although the subject that he and Chris have on the Sunday show is anything but comical. We're going to pick up, though, from what Chris Stein and Neil DeBeer spoke about on the Sunday show this week as it relates to the Government of National Unity and the potential disbandment thereof.
It now becomes apparent that Cyril Ramaphosa goes ahead without informing these people in the GNU, in specifically John D. McPherson and those odds and sods that make up the cabinet, that he was going to sign the land expiration bill. This is shocking, not because this is a matter of, oh, I forgot and will brief you later, but in my opinion, a direct calculator scenario of embarrassing the people who are actually going to have to put it to the test and to the road. But in my opinion, Cyril was influenced to do so, so that he could garnish a couple of extra support. Can you imagine sitting in Davos as the leader of the formal opposition, a cabinet minister, and you get told this huge bill being signed on social media? What is more shocking, Chris, is that the minister who will have to take that bill and implement it is Dean McPherson. And now it comes out that Minister McPherson, who also is under attack and will get there, is currently saying that about a month or few, he actually got legal opinion that the current bill as signed by the president is not carrying constitutional muster. And what does Cyril do? He takes that document and puts it into pile Z and signs it irrespective of advice from the cabinet minister who will have to go and make it constitutional. So that is the litany of what happened in this week. And now we've got a matter where John strongly came out. But we have to understand, Chris, he can't just now throw toys out of the car. He has to now go to the table and see if he can save the GNU. And that's why he used the words yesterday verbatim. We will have to ask the president to reset the GNU. And that is where we left yesterday's total litany of the land expiration bill. And then lastly, Chris, on this matter, Dean McPherson stands his ground, goes out and says, I am not going to implement this act in my department. And not a day later, Paul Mashatile, who is still under a cloud of absolute scrutiny, comes out and threatens Dean McPherson and says, if he does not want to implement the laws of this country, then he must resign as a minister. And typical Dean clubs back and says, yo, Moore, I won't resign. That is up to the member and leader of the DA. So that's where we are. The GNU currently standing in this grey matter. And John, rightfully so yesterday, invoking what they call Clause 19 in the discussion document and the contract document, which means they are calling for a formal dispute.
Wow, we're at a time in our history that we're going to look back on and no doubt remember. Moving abroad now, and one of the other big stars at the World Economic Forum in Davos last week, other meaning relative to Javier Milei of Argentina, was Donald Trump. I was in the plenary hall when Trump was piped in via video, and he received a warm reception from the 900 people who were assembled. That's as much as the plenary hall can manage, and many who were outside watching the video stream. He said, as part of that discussion, drill, baby, drill. And it really is part of a belief by Trump and those who he is leading in America that they will be able to double the amount of energy that America produces. And that is going to be required, they believe, to fuel the data centers that are intended to be invested in the United States. Well, this is all came out before the whole story of DeepSeek, which is in China, and we'll have more details on in a moment. But even before that, the Financial Times, our partners in London, are raising some flags as to say, it's not really practically possible for America to deliver the kind of energy increase that Donald Trump is proposing. And certainly, while he might be calling for drill, baby, drill, it's not very likely that those who will be doing the drilling are going to be able to actually achieve it. Here are our partners at the Financial Times.
It's become one of Donald Trump's most recognizable catchphrases.
We will drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill.
The problem is, despite the go-ahead from Trump, it turns out the shale industry doesn't have big plans to boost production. The FT's Jamie Smith is here to break down the slogan from the economic realities. What sort of actions did Donald Trump take during his first week in office when it comes to oil and gas?
Well, on his first day, he actually published a blizzard of executive orders, and one of those was declaring a national energy emergency in the US. In these orders, he really sets out a plan to boost oil and gas production, put energy at the center of US national security, repeal environmental rules, and basically redirect funding and the might of the federal government to try and promote fossil fuels and shift away from renewables.
Ordinarily, I'd assume that the fossil fuel industry would be, you know, over the moon about less red tape. But apparently that's not the case.
Well, I think executives are generally happy that Donald Trump and a Republican administration is now in place, but they are not suggesting that they're going to do their bidding in terms of the drill, baby, drill slogan that Trump has been espousing. There's really several reasons why they don't think they're going to be able to produce a lot more in the short term. I mean, one reason is the US is actually already producing at record levels. And for the last 6 years has been the biggest producer of crude oil in the world. But we're getting to a period where it's difficult and expensive for these producers to push ahead and boost production. So big producers like Chevron and Conoco, they've said they will cut spending this year. And in the Permian, the heartland of US oil production, more than half of producers have signaled they will cut spending in 2025. Trump's urging them to produce more oil and gas at a time when global demand for oil in particular is weakening. So that makes oil producers cautious about boosting production. Analysts are predicting that oil prices are going to end this year below $70. And that's a level that doesn't allow US oil shale producers to make a lot of profit and incentivize extra drilling for the new oil and gas reservoirs that they need to boost production.
So cheaper oil might be good news for green energy advocates right now. But do you think we'll see renewed investment in shale eventually?
I think one thing about these repeal of environmental laws, Trump is saying he's going to make a big push on permitting. Now, that is a really big issue in the US. It's very difficult to build new gas and oil pipelines. So if there is some sort of move in permitting and, you know, speeding up the building of these types of pipelines, that would be beneficial. But it probably takes several years for that to happen. And by that stage, Donald Trump might not be in an office and we could have a Democrat administration which could reverse some of these policies. One of the executives I spoke to on this topic, you know, he said Wall Street is driven by financial returns. It's not driven by political slogans. And that seems to be the theme that's taking hold at the minute.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking, out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, while the rest of the world is focusing its attention on the war between Ukraine and Russia and also to what's happening in the Middle East, much closer to home, a war is brewing between Rwanda and the DRC. Our partners at Bloomberg picked up this report today, and here are the highlights for you.
Rwanda-backed M23 rebels claim they have captured eastern Congo's largest city of Goma. The United Nations has described a, quote, mass panic among its 2 million people, and Congo's government says the rebel advance is a, quote, declaration of war. For more on this, let's bring in Bloomberg's Andira Oganga, who is in Kigali for us following the story. So, Andira, walk us through how the situation in eastern Congo has escalated like this in the past few days.
Hi, Jen. This fighting has really taken a different turn in the last couple of days. Let's take a look at the last 24 hours, for example. On the 26th of January, Bloomberg reported that the M23 rebels were just 9 kilometers north of Goma. On the 27th in the morning, we woke up to news that M23 rebels have seized the town of Goma. And they posted on their X saying, "We urge all residents of Goma to remain calm. The liberation of the city has been successfully carried out." Goma is a town near the border of Rwanda, and it's a key trading hub. And this cessation or seizure by M23 rebels could mean that there could be full war prospects that we could be looking at. You also have M23 rebels that have seized control of the airspace in DRC, and they've blocked all movement of people and humanitarian aid in and out of this city. And you have the UN saying that water, electricity infrastructure has been damaged, humanitarian aid workers are running out of money. Then you have people. Goma was one of the last safe havens in the eastern part of DRC. People are fleeing, not knowing where to go. Their children and whatever belongings they could pack on their bags. The UN says at least 178,000 people have been displaced since January. And from the recent fighting that we've seen, 3 peacekeepers from South Africa and Uruguay have been killed and 11 have been wounded.
And Andir, we were just talking a few days ago about Rwanda and the DRC and potentially Turkey helping to mediate some resolution between the two. What does this latest development then mean for that?
Tension is fast rising between the two countries. You have the government of DRC that accused Rwandan troops of crossing the border, terming it as a declaration of war. You also have Congo, the U.S. and the U.N. accusing Rwanda of backing M23 rebels, not only with weapons, but also boots on the ground. The U.N. also says that Rwanda has been using GPS jamming and spoofing equipment that is blocking relief efforts. And because M23 have now seized Goma, they control the world's largest deposit of tantalum ore that is used in portable electronics. And these minerals are being shipped to Rwanda and then loaded into the global ecosystem, according to DRC. And they're asking an embargo to be placed from gold and coltan that is coming from Rwanda. On the other hand, Rwanda is responding. The ambassador to Rwanda, or rather the ambassador to UN from Rwanda, says Congo's inability to govern itself and control active armed groups is the root cause of problems in that country. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs also in Rwanda has released a statement criticizing the lack of context in the statement that are being put out there. They're saying they're misguided and manipulative. Rwanda is being scapegoated. But all in all, Rwanda remains to a peaceful process and finding peace in DRC.
Pretty hectic stuff there. And the South African deaths now have risen into double figures. The South Africans being part of that UN peacekeeping force that are coming under fire from the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. So close to home. And something that we are now finally starting to pay attention to. Well, something else we pay attention to is the markets. And to bring you up to date with some pretty heavy moves that we've seen in the markets today, the Financial Times in London, our partners there, brought out an article today about tech stocks taking a hiding. And this is a direct result of China's deep seek, which is allegedly, well, we'll hear in just a moment, apparently funded with only $6 million, which would hardly be buying lunch for the American AI firms if you take them all together. But as you can see, if you're looking at the screen now, if you're listening in, it is the pre-market opening pricing. ASML Holdings, which is a producer of chips for, computer chips for all kinds of uses, but including the products that it makes are used to make chips, including those for AI. It was down 10.5% in Europe today. Tencent Holdings, on the other hand, which is supposedly one of the major beneficiaries of China getting really good at AI, that share price is up by 1.25%, and the South African relation of Tencent, Prosus, Naspers, remember they own a big chunk of Tencent shares, about a third of it, that was up today as well against the trend. But in the United States, NVIDIA, which is in many ways the flag bearer for AI stocks, dropped, fell 3% on Friday. It's down 10% ahead of the market opening today on the DeepSeek news. TSMC, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer, it makes more chips than anyone else in the world. That is down 8% in pre-market trade. And some of the other stocks that are related to AI, even the mighty Microsoft, have also taken a hit. Microsoft down by 4% today, and others, Alphabet, etc., taking a similar knock. Let's have a look at what all the fuss is about. Here are our partners at Bloomberg.
Over the past few days, a Chinese AI company has been making waves in Silicon Valley, and my pen just dropped onto the floor.
I'll grab it for you. But yeah, go ahead, keep reading.
That's because AI models have, from DeepSeek, have been scoring impressively on global benchmarks. The free, open-source large language model was unveiled in December. The lab behind it says it took 2 months and under $6 million to build. I think that's a key point right there. That's a fraction of what OpenAI and Google spent to train their models. Dave?
Yeah, $6 million.
it's how much has OpenAI and Meta and Google and Tesla spent combined?
Well, I know of more expensive apartments in Hong Kong than the budget it took to get this up. Last week, the founder of DeepSeek was the only AI leader selected to attend a meeting of entrepreneurs with Chinese Premier Li Qiang. And over the weekend, Xinhua published this editorial on how China's AI advances are working despite Washington's tech curbs on the country. Robert Li is with us, our Bloomberg Intelligence senior analyst. So, you told us so.
Well, we've been writing on this company for the best part of 6 or 7 months. And I think for anybody who follows the China AI sector closely, as we do, the profile has been relatively high within this, in this part of the world. But what you've seen over the last week or so, you know, prompted by the coverage and, as you said, the meeting with the premier, it's helped raise the company's profile both nationally and also externally. And it's been, this story's been picked up by a number of external news outlets. But, you know, Bloomberg Intelligence, some lead, others follow. We've been, you know, very active on this for, as I said, for quite some time.
It was the talk of the town in Davos, from what I understand. So what is the secret sauce, if you will? Is it the low cost, or is, do they have the processing power for the training and the deep learning?
Yeah, well, taking a step back, with the export restrictions you saw on the NVIDIA chips, etc., has been a major challenge. There is clear evidence, I think, that the big tech platforms, the Alibabas and Tencents of this world, both preemptively accumulated inventory of chips beforehand and have maybe, you know, gained a helping hand from their friends in other parts of the world to gain access to these chips. But then for smaller companies such as DeepSeek, although they still have access to a sufficient number of chips, you know, this challenge has prompted them to become more innovative. And so the way in which they've developed the models is a far more computationally effective and therefore requires less chips and allows them to undercut their rivals cost-wise or price-wise significantly. So without going into the technical detail on DeepSeek, it's something called a mixture of experts. It's the architecture they use, you know, one of the first in the industry to do this. They've really managed to forge ahead. And as you mentioned in your preview, you know, are ranked top 10 in terms of global large language models. So I think, again, this just highlights and illustrates the point that whilst Chinese tech companies faced, you know, problems on the semiconductor and chip side, they have a very strong track record in terms of innovation and software. Alibaba, Tencent are two of the world's leading tech platforms. And that, you know, in numerical terms, China has more software developers than the US by a ratio of approximately 3 to 1.
Quite a story, DeepSeek shaking up investment markets around the world. Well, I hope that you enjoyed today's episode of the BizNews Briefing. We'll be back again with tomorrow's episode tomorrow. Until then, cheerio. This BizNews Briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.